Now, to refresh my memory, what questions were you?
21 to 14.
Those are matching columns, and they are basically from the autobiography, so that there is no, now there was no guessing. Giving is less enjoyable.
29.
When the other person asks for something. Is that what she says? Anybody have another?
22.
Please?
22.
Giving is less enjoyable. Instincts of our nature. God. You're right. Giving is less enjoyable to our nature. And the other answer? 25. When people ask us to do them a favor, maybe, sister, maybe that is the best. What do you think? Giving is less enjoyable when people ask us to do them a favor. Now, would we say, however, that it is therefore less meritorious, because people ask us to do them a favor and it's less enjoyable? Is what is less enjoyable also less meritorious? Oh. Can be more meritorious if it is less enjoyable, provided our not enjoying it is not our own fault. 22. We are naturally sensitive to 26. How people ask for something. Is that what you said?
27.
We are naturally sensitive to loving the, well, you could say that, but I think the other one is better. You'll find out how many we have left over. What is going to open my heart? Why? Question.
21.
Nothing but love. Okay. What should show our gratitude, or rather, we should show our gratitude? Daniel, how about it?
I had 25, but apparently it's 29.
And used up already, huh?
It's 29.
29? We should show our gratitude when the other person asks for something. By the way, this is not natural psychology, believe me. But it's very instructive, isn't it? So, 25. These deplorable, if you're coming closer, it's warmer in here. These deplorable,
22,
instincts of our nature. So, to deplore is to weep over. Okay. Only God can see into the depths of our hearts. Did you say 30? All our human views are short-sighted. And that's an understatement, short-sighted. Very, very short-sighted. And that's why holy persons, as surely the little flower was, could see things that a lifetime of education would not teach a person. God, in other words, enables us to see what we could never perceive with our natural ability, no matter how good. Christ's teaching, 27. Really? Loving the unlovable. Any other suggestion?
23.
Goes against our natural instincts. Sounds good to me. Christ's teaching goes against our natural instincts. And that is why. And this takes a lifetime to learn. I like the people that I'm talking to. I want to feel safe that I'm the oldest person in the audience. And of course, if we then remain faithful to Christ's teaching and propose Christ's teaching, well, people will also be, well, not so friendly to us. Unless they realize what we're doing is communicating Christ's teaching. How peace comes flooding into the soul.
24.
When, once it learns to rise above its natural sensitiveness, it's good to me. Any other? Okay. We should give people 28. More than they ask for. Oh, did I tell you? A couple of weeks ago, maybe I mentioned this, told this story. I had a letter to send. I had to be sent out before 5 o'clock, 15 to 5. So I wrote the letter. I didn't have any stamp. So now normally we just put the letters into the mailbox at our residence there, and the priest in charge of the mail, he just puts stamps on and sends it off. But I had to send it off, so I had to buy a stamp. So I went to a place along Liberty where they sell stamps. I tell you this? And I asked, do you sell stamps here? Yeah, one of the people said, no, that was her department. They didn't sell stamps. So then she looked over there. They might sell stamps. So sure enough, they're selling stamps. So I said, you sell stamps? The fellow said, yes. I won one stamp. 29-cent stamp. So he came back with a 29-cent stamp. And of course, I came. I was ready. Had a quarter and 4 pennies. He said, that'll be 40 cents. So I said, fine. So I took the 4 pennies back and I gave another quarter. I said, keep the change. And then, I didn't take the quiz before I did that. But after I mailed the letter, I said 3 Hail Marys for the man. Does that make sense? Sure, he can use them. And if I remember, gee, that night he told his wife, strange things happen. Selling a priest, 29 cents stamp, I told him it was 40 cents. He gave me 2 quarters and he thanked me. Where are we? We should give people, what is it? More than they ask for. By the way, that's real. This is not make-believe. And remember, not only what people ask for, like the man asked for 40 cents, that was pretty obvious. They give even more than they expect. Because most people don't ask verbally, or, you know, send you a letter or a notice. There are 1,000 ways of asking, and most of them are not verbal. People that can ask for things without saying a word. Okay. And finally, Christian charity. Please? 27. Loving the unlovable. Yes. Now, I must admit that besides the little flower, I think I put some of my ideas in there too. But in the light of her own teaching. Now, encircle the letter of the term that best completes each sentence. In dealing with souls, God acts. The same, differently, distinctively, with each individual person.
See.
Distinctively. In fact, that is the best definition of a person. A person, remember we said, was an individual rational being, or better, individual intelligent being. But if you want to make that word individual even more clear, a person is a distinctive intelligent being. In other words, not only are we different, but we are identifiably different. Distinctively, identifiably, so much so that our personality, well, is not only different from other people, but identifies us as persons. The primary graces we receive from God
please see.
Any other suggestions?
A.
Please?
A, that you have to illuminate the mind first because the will is blind.
Yes, it really is. Primary, the word primary does not mean necessarily most important, but most fundamental. The most important thing in a building is not the foundation, but you better have a foundation. It's primary. So, illuminations of the mind are primary. And the food of real love is
B.
Suffering. C. Succubus. Too bad I didn't have five options. I think it's B. Please? Who the real love is. Well, patience is already what we gain from suffering. In other words, between the two, suffering is the condition. Patience is the effect. I cannot be patient unless I suffer. And I cannot offer a sacrifice unless there is some suffering involved. But I'd say the real, this is what I've been teaching over the years, and over the years again in teaching, having taught these masters of the spiritual life, not just these, but so many over the years, afterwards, your mind becomes filled with their ideas. As you know, what we learn from others. So that suffering, I think, is the best answer. Thank you. The basic food of the spiritual life is A, B, or C. The basic food. Carolyn?
C.
You see? C. Reveal truth. Oh, C. Light and strength for the soul.
B
is better. And notice what I'm doing. Sapur, obviously, I pull things out. The word basic, primary. The mind. And the little flower is such a great saint, not only because of her heroic virtue, but because of her strong faith, which we believe with the mind. Without the grace of God, we cannot. Sister Superior?
See.
Millis. I mean, you're right. Please? What'd you say?
B.
That is the best answer. Perform any action leading to heaven. It is not true that we cannot do anything good without grace. It's not true. In fact, that's almost the heart of Protestantism. That a person cannot do any good without grace. Which means that we don't have a free will. First of all, that we don't have a mind that can recognize what is good. We don't have a free will to choose the good. We can. Our minds are darkened, but they're not blind. Our wills are weakened, but they're not helpless. Not a subtle distinction. So we cannot do anything leading to heaven. That's when Jesus said, without me you can't do nothing. You can see what Luther and others would do with that statement. We can't do nothing, period. Christ did not mean we cannot do anything. Oh my gosh. We don't need God's grace to say, take a sip of water. And so we can do, and even we can do things that are good, morally good. Now, listen. We're talking here theologically. We're not saying that we ever perform any good action without the grace of God. We're not saying that. Only God knows. But we have to ask the question, can we perform a morally good action without God's grace? We have to say yes. Otherwise, only one of two or both reasons would be true, and they're not. If we could not do anything good without grace, it would have to be either because our minds are absolutely blind to recognize the good. Is that true? We still have an intellect. And it's, in other words, it is capable of thinking. Or if the mind could recognize what is good without God's grace, then we wouldn't have a free will. And then we couldn't do any good, because doing any good means not merely knowing what is good, but choosing it. And as we know, 6 whole nations were lost to the Catholic Church. Now, there were other factors, but this was the fundamental one. This is the essence of Protestantism, the heart of it, inner core. And man is absolutely helpless to know anything true or anything truly good without grace, or can choose anything except with God's grace. In other words, that we do not have an intellect that can know the truth, God must do the thinking for us. Or we cannot choose any good, God must use the choosing for us. Is that true? Now, when it comes to choosing what is to lead to heaven, well, that's different. Notice we're not saying that. So that without grace we cannot perform any action leading to heaven. That's true. But we cannot say that we cannot, as human beings, do anything good without God's grace, because then God will be doing it for us. So, 36. In His ordinary providence, God.
I have A, Father.
You have A. Uses person as source of grace to others. Yeah, Sister Freddie would say, Father, those are tricky. Uses person as source of grace to others. Allows others to be source of grace for us. Uses us as a channel of grace for others. Which is the best answer?
A.
May I ask, does A include C? It must be better than if it includes C. It must be better. Then, what is higher, for God to use persons or to allow others, and even to be source of grace for us? So, A is the only really good answer. Number 37. In proportion as we deny ourselves any kind of self-indulgence, our affection for another person becomes. Somebody back there. C. More selfless. I think that's the best answer. 38. Souls are to be guided along the road which Sister Severia?
B.
Which God marks out for them. So not we think is best for them. Pardon me, I don't even want to ask anybody. Did anybody choose any other answer except? This is, by the way, this is basics. Spiritual counseling. Spiritual guidance. And St. Ignatius warns us in Guiding Souls, find out where God's grace is leading that person. People are different, provided it, of course, is according to God's will and not contrary to His will. God uses people in strange ways. So, and God marks out for souls the way they are to be guided by what? By the circumstances of their life. The temperature outside. The heater here. Oh. Everything. In other words, God is behind everything. Including people's mistakes. Even if people are unkind to us. Yeah. 39. Selfless affection for others.
B.
You think B. Selfless affection for others is most effective in guiding souls. You would see. Selfless affection for others does not seek affection from them in return. Well, that's, by the way, both B and C are true. Anybody have A? Oh, this is delightful. You know, the saints in heaven know what we're doing. Must be enjoying themselves. Mary in context, first of all, does not seek his own benefit. That's true. Does not seek affection from them in return. That is also true. But I believe in context, B is the, I think, the best answer. Is most effective in guiding souls. And let me tell you, and people find out very soon, whether you're looking for something in return, including, by the way, expecting, well, them to think well of you in return. Do you sometimes have to tell people what they don't like? With deep, selfless affection. Oh, yes.
Really? No, not necessarily. I mean, to help other people. Like
we don't expect even spiritual. No. In other words, we're not looking for it.
Shouldn't we want
to? Yeah, look. There's nothing wrong, my gosh, of course, in wanting it. But if it is totally selfless, now God, in other words, objectively we know we never do anything good for anyone, really good, without God rewarding us. On the other hand, and this is, as we say in Italian, molto importante, very important. See, we kind of expect, you know, an early return. See, we do something good for somebody, like at 9:15. Well, you might wait till 9:25 or maybe even 10 o'clock. And it may be that what we're going to get in return, we won't even get in this life. And it might even be when we get to heaven. You'll find out. Because, see, heaven is going to be for all eternity. So in the thousandth century of eternity, we had to wait this long. Be like quick return, see? Not with God. Number 30. Number 40. Telling other people their faults requires prudence and charity, great tact in correcting others, true Christian charity. By the way, are all three true? Yes. So, wait, you have a prudence and charity. Okay? Great tact in correcting others, and do you have another answer? You have A. Anybody have anything else but A?
C.
Well, I think A is best because it covers two virtues. See, B is basically prudence. Tact is just a shorter word for prudence. And Christian charity, well, so prudence and charity, in other words, in telling other people their faults, is not just enough to be prudent, you've got to also be charitable. And not just to be charitable, I cannot tell you how offensive your conduct is, then proceed to read off. See? And I'm doing this out of charity. There are different ways of doing it, you see. So prudence and charity. And in this case, the kind of prudence which will really inspire the person to correct his fault. What good is it to correct another person? In fact, a lot of people get a lot of satisfaction out of correcting people. Okay, so they've corrected people. So they have corrected people. Period. But nothing happens. That in correcting people, instinctively, everyone defends himself. Instinctively. So you try to have the person recognize, you know, their own fault. And they kind of lead up to this, up to and down to the subject. See? And when I talk to just superiors, for example, about these subjects, and never having been a superior myself, I can talk very freely. But both prudence and charity. Okay. Now, may I ask, did I give you people 41? Okay. So then, if you do then 41 to 60 for next. Well, did I give that to you? One more. I didn't click. One more. See what you can find here. See, because up to 60 is there. So that would be needed, wouldn't it? Please?
This is in the Augustine
class. Oh.
Thank you.
St. Augustine. Oh. See if you can find it in there. Yeah, now if we can go over the chart on Teresian spirituality. Yeah, good luck. No luck, eh? Sorry.
It's okay, Father. I'll get a copy.
Okay. Sorry. So let's go over the Teresian spirituality. This being the 15th of October, I think it's appropriate. Remember, it's St. Teresa of Avila, and she's also called St. Teresa of Jesus. Now, just about the historical context. The Carmelite beginnings, actually, as we know, the Carmelite order goes centuries before St. Teresa. There were abuses among the contemplatives which had to be corrected. And then gradually the Carmelite order, as it was known at the time of St. Teresa, It was in existence, as we believe, for centuries before. And some would say, tracing its origins to which prophet? To the prophet?
Elijah.
Okay. Now, Teresa's own biography, 1515 to 1582. And now there are two different dates for her death, depending on whether you follow the Gregorian or the Julian calendar. In the Gregorian calendar, it is October the 15th. In the Julian calendar, it would be October the 4th. A couple of things might be noted regarding her biography. That she was a convert boarder with the Augustinians. Then entered the Carmelites. Then took ill. And is well to notice, her reconversion did not take place until 1553. Then certain people that entered her life, notably St. Francis Borgia, who was a Jesuit, our third Jesuit general, and St. Peter of Alcantara. And she had to reform the Carmelite order and had to do for the Carmelites in the 16th century what has to be done in so many communities throughout the world in the 20th century. Massive, massive reform. There are about 4,000 religious communities, different communities in the church today. In the United States, I know among the women there are 362 women's communities in the United States. Most of them need reform. Of the 362, my estimate is, I think I mentioned this to you, at least 100 will disappear by about maybe 2025 in the next 35 or 40 years. No way they can survive. No way. And that's what happened in the 16th century. As I've been again telling people over the years, the history of religious communities is that the communities begin very dedicated, strongly committed to the charism of the founder. As the community gets larger and begins to spread, weakness sets in. That's the history of every religious community, no exceptions. And then some cases take longer to need reform, some cases doesn't take that long. But one of two things happens. When the community becomes worldly, secularized, whatever term you use, there's either a reformation or it goes out of existence. And most religious communities in the history of the church have gone out of existence. Let me say it again. Most religious communities in the history of the church have gone out of existence. It is sobering, but it's just straight truth. And that is why, for example, Saint Benedict, because when he came along, that was already 6th century. He saw what had been going on for 500 years. So what he did, and this is also Teresa of Avila's genius, the bigger the community, the harder it is to maintain solidarity, because you just have many people. So what Teresa did, and centuries before her, in fact a thousand years before her, Saint Benedict, formed small monastic, we call them monastic communities. In other words, the number of members in a community, that's by rule, would be small. But then, here's the difference. Not only would the number of members be small, but each community was autonomous, was independent. Of course, then you're at the mercy of the superior. That's why there's a woman doctor in Chicago that wants to become a contemplative. So I've been counseling her for about 4 years, and well, I recommended the Carmelites in Dallas, Texas. So I got a call last night from the prioress in Dallas, very happy that I recommended this woman doctor to join this Carmelite community in Dallas, Texas. She's in Chicago. Because communities differ. Oh, how they differ. At any rate, Teresa of Avila then reformed the Carmelites. Now, she reformed quite a few convents. And since this has been, I would say, my single principal work in the church the last 25 years has been working with religious communities, especially women's communities. And I can tell you, they need drastic reformation in our country. Most of them. And even among the good ones, pressure is terrific. Now, what are the principal features? First of all, the principal source of her spirituality. Where do you find out how Teresa of Avila thought? What were her, you might say, principles of the spiritual life? You find them in, especially in three of her works, in her autobiography, in A Way of Perfection, and most especially in her work called Interior Castle. And in teaching, for example, contemplative spirituality, since people don't have all kind of time, especially if they're studying in class, what is one work to really get to the heart of Teresian spirituality? It's her Interior Castle. Okay. Now, I notice I pulled out 17 features. Gosh, that's a lot of features. Well, I don't mean that it's even exhaustive. However, I thought I'd say more than less to bring out something of her spirituality. First of all, primacy of prayer in the spiritual life. Now, the primacy is both in terms of time and energy. In other words, what you give most of your time to, according to Teresa, is prayer. And to guarantee that, of course, they have the divine office, which is, should be at least, chanted. And that takes 4 to 5 hours a day, depending on the day, depending on how long the office is. And besides that, of course, adoration before the Blessed Sacrament. And when I gave the retreat to the Dallas Carmelites, I got one. She called me. First, be there. But they have a grill, and of course they can see the Blessed Sacrament. So that, and really, it's a better way, I think, that some convents have the grill you know, behind the altar, which is all right. But then the people just know there's something, you know, behind the altar. The Dallas Carmelites have it, as you enter the chapel, it's to the left. So you can see the grill, and you can hear them singing too. So the primacy of prayer, and let's face it, and not just mental prayer, but vocal prayer. And it's very important in a contemplative community for the voice also to be trained, to cultivate the voice. Because God is glorified not only by singing, but by singing well. Number two, primacy of grace and the growth in holiness. Now you see, number one would contrast prayer with work. Prayer with work. Number two would contrast grace with free will. We need both. We need both our own free will to grow in holiness. We need God's grace. So it's not just a pious cliche with Teresa. Holiness is mainly due to God's grace, which means that whatever can gain grace for me will enable me to go in grace, even though nobody in the community, for example, thinks that I'm any more holy. Anytime the community thinks I'm holy, and if I agree with them, I'm in trouble. Number three, prayer, according to Teresa, is normative of spiritual group progress. And she's been reading her works. She has talking about a person growing in prayer and uses four figures of speech. Carrying water, that's the most laborious. And by the way, in case you don't know, water can be, you should know, you sisters, water can be pretty heavy. Who knows how much a pint of water weighs? Oh, memorize this. A pound, the world over. A pint of water weighs 1 pound. How's that? So a gallon of water weighs how much? Four times two, 8 pounds. And the next is a windlass. What is that? What is a windlass? What is that? When you, well, see, that's easier. And carrying water is easier to, you know, wind the windlass. Get the water to come up. There's a rope. See? The bucket is down below on you. Okay. Then it's still easier irrigation. Once the irrigation is set up. And of course, the best is rain. Now, these are four figures of speech that the Teresa gives for recognizing one's spiritual progress by one's, well, effort at prayer. Now, we could talk for hours now to explain this. But in general, we grow in holiness, Teresa would say, as we grow in the facility to pray. Number 4, growth is conditioned. Notice the two different verbs. Growth is conditioned by effort, but determined by grace. Our growth in the spiritual life, or in holiness, depends on our effort. We've got to exert ourselves. But how much we grow is determined by God, by His grace. No two people are equally holy. And the holiest people are not necessarily the people that have worked the hardest. Already was conceived without sin in the state of grace. Needless to say, she had made no effort. Number 5. This is a famous statement of St. Teresa. Reparation by substitution. That's worth $1 billion. What are people not doing that they should be doing? Very well. If you want to make reparation for their sins, then you do what they are not doing, or you do more of what they're doing less. In other words, you gain grace for them, you glorify God in the measure in which you, realizing how God's majesty is being deprived of glory by people not doing what they should be doing, then you do what they should be doing. But that's their business. Not quite. That's what reparation is all about. How many wives and husbands I've told, look, you are the principal channel of grace to your spouse. Number 6, sanctification through community life. 24 hours in a religious community. And I never realized it was like this. Well, stay around, you'll find you'll learn more. Guaranteed sanctification. You just stick it out. Because you don't tell the other members of the community how hard they are to live with. That spoils everything. And of course, sisters, I think, would agree with me. See, there are no secrets in the community. You know that. No secrets. And the smaller the community, the less anybody can keep a secret, see? So privacy. By the end of the first month in the novitiate, I decided, well, told myself, Hardin, if you didn't want to do this, you should have met the Jesuits. There's no privacy. Yeah, you know what I mean. So everybody knows everybody else's business. Number 7. Solitude for recollection and growth. What does the Latin word solus mean? Alone. Solus, alone. Sola, for a woman. And now, solitude does not mean, and Teresa surely does not mean, that the solitude is being, you might say, wrapped up in your own, if I can use the expression, squirrel cage, you see. It is solitude from unnecessary communication with other human beings. Why? In order to be in communication with whom? With God. And that, by the way, is one thing which contemporary communities have got to be very careful to make more than their share of mistakes. in getting, for example, what we call loners into a community. Well, they may love, you know, the contemplative life. At long last, they're away from the crowd. Yeah. They're away from the crowd, all right. Well, they're wrapped up in their own selves. There's nothing contemplative life. You follow me? And in screening, as I have, and in interviewing candidates for contemplative communities, people who like to be alone. Now, there can be exceptions, but they generally don't make the best contemplatives. So a person chooses solitude, not because you want to be away from the crowd, escaping from the world. See? Because you want to escape from the world, it's much worse to be alone with yourself. Much worse. Just wrapped up in self. Number 8. Right thinking necessary for perfection. That's why she is a doctor of the church. And she has some very fine, as we know, spiritual direction. It is not commonly realized. Notice, 1515. She was born. 1517, Martin Luther broke with the church. In 1546, Martin Luther died. 1563, the Council of Trent closed. See, it's at the time when a revolution hit the church. That's what the church desperately needs today. Saints. In fact, in case nobody told you, nobody else will survive. And your sisters are not. You're not safe from the world because you're in the convent. Okay, nobody told you. Seeps in through the walls. So, right thinking. And she recognized instinctively that the ideas of Luther, Calvin, and the rest of them, the ideas, were false. It was women like Teresa, men like John of the Cross, that saved Spain for the church. Spain never became Protestant. Number 9. Love in details. Now this, of course, is part of her womanly nature. See, women, my gosh, Daniel, just the two of us here in chapel. Well, the rest are in dealing with women religious, or in the direction of women. There's a specificity, a detail about the spirituality of Saint Teresa that you just don't find in men. It has to be just so. And of course then, like, well, how many wives have complained, Father? If my husband only knew how much time I spend making that salad, and I put it just so everything would be even the looks of the salad, so it's attractive. And then even complains, oh Father, how it hurt me. You know what I'm saying? Well, this is part of a woman's nature, and then grace builds on that nature. Teresa is a master of detail in the spiritual life. Okay. And when we love somebody, we are concerned about details. Number 10, humility through daily growth in self-knowledge. That's the hard one. There's no humility without humiliation. In fact, in Latin, there's a verb, humiliare. to humiliate, or humiliare, to be humiliated. The principal source of humiliation should be self-knowledge. A lot of people, stupid geese, or what's more stupid, stupid sheep, instead of looking at and seeing the failings they've got, they close their eyes. What a wonderful person am I. Blind ducks. That should be the principal source of our humiliation. And of course, as we all know, other people are always so happy to cooperate in pointing out our weaknesses. Yeah, it can be, you know, just little things. But it's those little things that can hurt. Well, so the fact that I'm still so proud that I'm hurt by somebody. Father, she passed me the quarter. She didn't even look at me. Those are graces, blessings, wonderful. See? So through self-knowledge, and of course, it presumes, number 10 presumes, the more we know about ourselves, the more we realize what's wrong with us. See? Anytime you think you're great, see, I didn't realize how good I was. You're in real trouble. Number 11. So, this is a quotation. Humility is to keep within the bounds of truth. That's a famous definition of Saint Teresa. What is humility? Humility is keeping within the bounds of truth. For example, the most fundamental humility is knowing the truth about our relationship with God. Except for God, we would be now what we were 9 months before we were born. Exactly, mathematically, metaphysically, zero. Nothing. And except for God, we would now be what we were before we became what we are, which is nothing. And that's the way we should act towards God, realizing we completely depend on Him. Everything we've got comes from Him. Everything. And, of course, with other people. Now, of course, we better realize what the relationship is between us and somebody else. See, if I'm the superior, well, the truth is I'm superior. So I don't go around asking, sister, you know, permission of the other sisters, may I do this, may I do that? Okay. That's not the truth, right? We'll see mother or father in the family. The truth is, they're in charge. I think I told you when I learned the truth at the age of 3, remember? On the kitchen floor, see? Stabbed by my mother. I never told you. You never heard that. Well, worth repeating. Whatever I did, my mother was stopping me. And it hurt, so I was screaming. She said, Johnny, you stop screaming, I'll stop whipping. So I thought to myself, well, that makes sense. See if it works. So I turned off the scream for a while, and the pain stopped. So I remember my first rational decision on the kitchen floor. No doubt what the truth was. My mother was in charge. When I got older, she didn't use a strap, but she could tell me what she thought I should be doing or shouldn't be doing. Number 12. Modesty, mortification, and these are the four things that she required of her own sisters. The habit, the religious habit. Do you know that many Carmelites in the United States, contemplative Carmelites, have removed their habit? Did you know that? They're gone. No hope for them. And fasting. Body mortification. Silence. And then enclosure. In other words, place where only the nuns could be with other people, except for special reasons, wouldn't be allowed to come. 13. Reform has returned to primitive rule. And the primitive rule we date historically to 1210. In other words, the Carmelites had become lax. And among the things that they became lax in was in conversation. Engaged in a lot of conversation. Giving spiritual direction. Oh, how much I can say here. At any rate, and that really is the essence of the reformation of religious community, getting back to its origins. 14. Practicality, realism, and psychological balance. That's Teresa. No theorizer, she. Then, realism. How many times I've said this? Some of the Carmelites which did not want to be reformed, she knew she was in danger of being killed by her sisters. Poisoned. So, she made sure that in some Carmelites which needed some drastic reform, she would eat only hard-boiled eggs. They couldn't spike the outside of the egg with, well, cyanide or some other poison. The world has not changed. Just got bigger. And then psychological balance. And that's extraordinary. In other words, she knew how far to go, when to stop, and above all, with all the mess in which Europe was in her day, she never became discouraged. And this is where we've got to protect ourselves in today's world from getting discouraged. That's why, you know, exposure to reading about or hearing about, the more of this gets into our minds afterwards, we become almost paralyzed. You know what I'm saying? So it's none of our business. Why bother me? Okay. 15. In this, I want to recommend, I have over the years, prayerful reflection through writing. From my first days of teaching theology, I've never ceased recommending, urging to grow in the spiritual life. Writing is very important. Writing disciplines the mind. Writing assists the memory. Writing makes us perceptive because we know what we want to put down, so we are observant, say, during the day, so we know what we should write. And writing is humiliating. Carl Newman said, most people don't like to write because they don't like to read what they've written. It's so humiliating. Because that's us. And there's no cosmetics. So she did her own short writing and recommended it to her, as you call them, daughters. Concern for orthodoxy. In other words, her spirituality was based on the church's teaching. And that meant, of course, obedience to the Pope. And as you know, over the centuries, not all the popes have been saints. Did you know that? You know, could anybody name one pope that will never be canonized? Alexander the Sixth. And guess what? Alexander the Sixth started his pontificate in 1492. And my memory doesn't fail me, he was pope until 1503. Ignatius was born in 1491. And one reason for the desperate need for reformation was that even the popes were not holy. But remember, whether it's a pope or a bishop, as long as he has authority in the church, we do not condition our obedience on the person's holiness, right? And that's hard, very hard. That's why millions, and for the 16th century, that's a lot of people, because there were, relatively speaking, fewer people in those days, but millions were lost to the Catholic Church. Mainly for two reasons: immorality of the clergy and ignorance of the faithful, of the laity. That combination is explosive. So she kept her balance, distinguishing carefully between the holder of the office, say the Pope or bishops, and being a successor either of Peter or of the apostles, as long as they are in office, insofar as, see, a bishop is a successor of the apostles, and listen to this, we've said this more than once, is in communion with the Pope, insofar as he agrees with what the Pope is teaching, he must be obeyed. And finally, sanctity through the rule. And it's she who said, "You observe the rule, and you'll be candidates for canonization." Now, the rule in Latin, the Latin word for rule is regula. And the verb is regulare. Some English word, to regulate, means to have a rule. And you might say, what's that got to do with me if I'm not a priest or a religious? Well, my friends, we should live a regulated life. There should be a schedule, order, sequence, so that we grow, therefore, through living a life that is regular, balanced. So today's feast, St. Teresa of Avila. And then for the next week. Now, did I give you the material? Do you have the notes? Okay. So, to be continued. Shall we pray? In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus.
Santa Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et in hora mortis nostri. Amen. Regina, Sancti Rosarii, in nomine Patris et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Do you have any papers on it?